My name is J.J. Survey, and I'm here to welcome you to the 14th Annual San Diego Jewish Book Fair, a program of San Diego Center for Jewish Culture at the Lawrence Family Jewish Community Center, Jacobs Family Campus, right here. This program is being underwritten by U.S. Trust, Bank of America, Private Wealth Management. Family Day on Sunday, November 9th, was underwritten by a generous grant from our founding benefactors, Dr. Andrew and Erna Viteri, and by Sempra Energy. The early childhood education is sponsored by Target. I have a tendency to say Target. Our co-sponsors today are the Robert and Mao Shulman Foundation and the Zionist Organizations of America. At the conclusion of this presentation, we will have a shortened question and answer period. Now, the usual usual request, please, please, please turn off your cell phones. We'd really appreciate that. After the presentation, there will be a question and answer period, as I said. Carolyn's book is, I'm going to talk about it in a second, it's going to be for sale. You probably have seen it, it's in the gallery, yeah. And she will be available to autograph them. Please remember that the Jewish Community Center benefits from books purchased here at the book fair, and that we all benefit as a result, because the proceeds from book sales also help provide our San Diego community with one of the best Jewish book fairs in the country. I don't know if all of you know that, but it is among the top book fairs in the country. There's also an opportunity for you to adopt a book for the wonderful Astor Judaica Library to help continue the Jewish tradition of learning in our community. Thank you for joining us. All right, now that we're done with the domestic stuff, let's talk about Carolyn. I have a tendency to say Carolyn. Chicago native Carolyn Glick moved to Israel in 1991 after receiving her BA in political science from Columbia University. She joined the Israeli army, where she served as an officer for 5.5 years. In her last 3 years of military service, Ms. Glick was a core member of Israel's negotiating team with the PLO and was later appointed to serve as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's assistant foreign policy advisor. After leaving government in 1998, Carolyn Glick received a master's in public policy from Harvard University and then returned to Israel. In 2002, she joined the Jerusalem Post and became a senior columnist and deputy managing editor. During Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, she was one of the only female journalists and the only Israeli one embedded on the front lines with U.S. infantry forces, reporting for Israel's TV's Channel 2, as well as the print media. Today, Ms. Glick's writings focus on the strategic and political issues challenging Israel and the United States. Ms. Glick lives in Jerusalem, but serves as a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. In her recently released book, Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad, in case you haven't seen it, this is it. I highly recommend it. If you have never read anything by Carolyn, this is a must. In this book, she examines the most important and troubling issues facing Israel and the world with one clear and coherent message, and that is Islamic fundamentalism is today the greatest challenge facing not just Israel and the U.S., but the entire Western world. And I will conclude by a non-scripted paragraph saying how much I enjoy, and probably a lot of you do too, reading Carolyn's, is it bi-weekly? Every 2 weeks. Sorry, twice a week. Twice a week, her column in the Jerusalem Post. She has a laser-like mind. She analyzes the situation, she's lucid, she's clear, and it's always a pleasure to see someone who sees the big picture. With that, please help me in welcoming Carolyn Glick.
that there's a booster step here. Can you all see me? Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here in San Diego. And I also have a couple people I would like to thank. I'd like to thank the Jewish Community Center here for having me. I'd like to thank the Zionist Organization of America for being co-sponsor of my talk this afternoon. I'd like to thank Mr. Robert Stillman, who was instrumental as well in bringing me here, and I'm sorry he's not here. I would have liked to have met him. And I thank all of you for coming and listening to me. So my book, as JJ pointed out, is called The Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad. And in it, you'll see a compilation of my columns from the Jerusalem Post that I wrote starting in 2002 and up to 2007. And what I tried to do with this book was take a chapter-by-chapter analysis of the major trends and issues that face the world today, and particularly Israel, and to look at it from a thematic perspective. What are the major themes, and how do we see these themes unfolding on a weekly basis, on a daily basis in our lives, and what does that mean about the world in which we live and how we're supposed to be looking at it? And, you know, it was very interesting because we look at the world very differently every day. And with the passing years, our perceptions of reality can change very drastically. Yesterday, I happened upon a book review in the New York Times of a new biography of Churchill. It was written by Robert Kagan, who is a very acute strategic analyst in Washington. And what Kagan noted that was interesting about this biography is that in 1900, young Winston Churchill, fresh from the battles in South Africa and in Omdurman with Lord Kitchener, came back to Britain, and he felt that he wouldn't have a chance for a true heroic calling in his lifetime because in 1900, young Winston Churchill, the age of 26, felt that the age of great wars between states was over. That the world in 1900, as he saw it, was a world with such interconnectivity between countries and great powers that simply as a result of that globalized economy, of that dependency, mutual dependency of neighboring countries, particularly in Europe, on one another, it would be impossible for another major war to break out in the 20th century. Now, Winston Churchill was a realist, as we know, because, of course, 14 years later, the Great War began. He was among the main strategists of the British military in that war, and then he went on to fight in Flanders with British forces. That war was such a calamitous war that many in Britain felt after the battles in the Somme that the elders of Britain had lost moral authority to send young Britons to war. And when you looked at British political culture in the 1920s and the 1930s, you saw a rejection of the authority of the British ruling classes by young men who had come back from the fields. And you saw an intense desire among the British to simply deny reality, to not look at what was happening in Hitler's Germany, to not look at the rise of fascism in other parts of Europe, particularly in Italy, and see that as a threat to the British way of life. And it was the same Churchill who in 1900 looked at the world around him and believed that war between great nations, great powers, was an impossibility, who then went through the cataclysmic war between 1914 and 1919 and was continuously able to scan the world around him, look at what people were saying, look at what people were doing, look at the way that people were defining themselves in their world, and turn around and say, we face an enormous danger from Nazi Germany. There is no way for us to peacefully coexist with Nazi Germany. There is no way for us to seek peace with Nazi Germany. I mean, Lord Halifax was one of the major British policymakers in the time. After the fall of Poland, said, no, we have to cut a deal with Hitler. We can't fight alone. There's no way. We need to make peace. We need to negotiate a peace. We need to appease Hitler. After the failure of the appeasement in 1938, we need to do that. It's better to live under surrender than to die in the field of battle. And Winston Churchill said, no. We have to fight. There is no option of peace. And I took that and I thought, now how interesting is that? What was Churchill's true greatness? It was to be able to stand in front of people who wish to deny reality and to say, just look at what's happening in our world today. Look at what's happening in Hitler's Germany. Look at how these people define the world and what it means to be German. And ask yourselves, how can a liberal British democracy coexist with that? People didn't want to hear it. Britain is far away from Germany, they said. Czechoslovakia could be on Mars. What do we care? What is our stake in all this? We can just live our lives happily. The change we want is to go back to where you were in 1900 and believe that we can make our world a peaceful place just by not wanting to fight. And he challenged him. He challenged the British people and he said, not that peace was wrong, but you have to look at the world in which you live. You can't decide if there's going to be peace if people around you want war. It's not up to you to decide for other people how they look at the world in which they live and what it means to be German. You cannot do it. It's not for you to say. It's not your decision. That's all. When we look at the world that we live in today, first starting in the 1990s, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, we had two very interesting theses that came out in the United States. One by Francis Fukuyama, who said that we had arrived at the end of history, that the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Soviet Empire, the Empire of Evil, as Reagan rightly called it, meant that democracy had won, meant that the notion of individual liberty and freedom had won, and that as a result of that definitive victory, we no longer had to worry about living inside of history. The cycles of history, the secular nature of human events had ended. Nothing would be anything other than peaceful in the future. Why? Because who could challenge the new order? No one, he said. On the other side was another professor named Samuel Huntington, who looked at the world and he said, what do we see? What is actually happening on the ground, not in our ivory towers where we discuss ideology and the birth or death of new ideas, but rather, what is happening on the ground? And he saw something interesting. He saw that throughout the world, the main conflicts, the edges of the conflicts, were always along the borders of Islam. Islam, he said, has bloody borders. Why? Because the perception of reality on the part of Islamic leaders is expansionist. Borders of peaceful countries between the United States and Canada, for instance, are not bloody. Because neither the United States wishes to expand northward, nor do the Canadians wish to expand southward. The self-perception of Americans and Canadians is not something that engenders a sense of expansionism, but rather a sense of acceptance of the borders of each country's power. This is not the case in the Islamic world. The opposite, in fact, is the case in the Islamic world. You have a relatively undeveloped economic system that is existent throughout the Islamic world. Most of the money that fuels the regimes of the Islamic world comes not from something that they created or built, but rather from something that they have, simply by virtue of geography, and that, of course, is oil. It's not something that they work for. It's not actually something that they even developed. That was Standard Oil's job. And yet, they're sitting on it, and they get it. It's a different mindset. If you look at Israel, for example, that has no natural resources other than potash. Why is it that the Israeli economy is the fastest growing economy in the Middle East, and why is it that Israel's GNP is twice that of all of its surrounding neighbors combined. Because we create. As the speaker who introduced JJ, I can't remember your name, was saying, Jews create, we don't destroy. And we don't take things as is. We're a revolutionary people that is constantly changing reality by building, by thinking, by moving, by being dynamic. But you look at the Arab world and you see a lack of intellectual curiosity, a lack of creativity on the one hand. You have a political culture that is not only misogynist, but is antithetical to the basic notions of the Western world, particularly the notion of the sanctity of life. When you have people upholding suicide and dying a martyr's death in the cause of the expansion of Islam, you have a culture that you have to confront that is quite simply the antithesis of everything that you are. Now, we consider this and decide that the best way to contend with it is to ignore it. How can people who eschew economic development and creativity be a threat? How can people who enslave half of their society simply because they're born female be a threat to us? How can a society whose economic growth is completely contingent on the fact that the Western world remains dependent on petroleum products be a threat to us? And so we have the strongest voices today in the West saying it is no threat. We don't have to worry. We add to that basic denial of the vibrancy and the importance of how over a billion people consider their world something else, which we also saw, by the way, in Winston Churchill's Britain in the 1920s and the 1930s, which is a rejection of the norms of the societies of the West. We had the creme de la creme of British society in the 1930s in the Oxford Union pledging not to sacrifice their lives for God and country. Never again would they take up arms in defense of Britain, which they didn't consider to be a particularly wonderful place. You had a rejection of the exceptionalism of the British Empire, of Britain, and all that it had given humanity for hundreds of years by its youth. And you had an intense desire to punish those who said that Britain stood for something, to reject them. And indeed, to a certain degree, that rejection of the moral authority of British values has endured to the current day. And here today, you have the same situation. If in the 1930s it was a rejection of Britain as exceptional, today we have an overall rejection of the notion not only of American exceptionalism, but of the value of Western civilization, not only among certain sectors of American society, but wide swaths of European society. The ideas of multiculturalism are alluring because they say, judge not lest thou be judged. But on the other hand, that statement is not necessarily a moral argument. In fact, it is an amoral argument. Because all of us stand in judgment at the end of the day, and all of us are responsible for our actions. And so if we don't want to be judged, what we're saying is we don't want to be held responsible for who we are and what we believe in. We want to be judged. Because if we want to move forward, we have to be able to judge others. But the whole doctrine of multiculturalism at the end of the day says to us, we're not going to judge, and you're not going to judge us. We're not going to take responsibility for who we are and the choices that we make in our lives, and as a result, we are not going to hold you responsible for the choices you make about who you are and how you wish to live your life. It's a rejection of the most basic core notion of Western civilization, and that is individual responsibility and of the necessity of personal judgment, that we bear responsibility for our choices in our lives and that we're willing to defend those choices. Multiculturalism not only does not judge, but it will not defend. Because he who cannot decide good from evil, who cannot say something is preferable to him over something else, will also not be able to defend himself. And yet, we see today, particularly since the end of the Cold War, when we should have, at least from a commonsensical perspective, an intuitive perspective, one might have thought that after the fall of the Soviet Union, there would be a spirit of triumphalism in the West. We would be proud of our accomplishments in destroying an evil created by man, in destroying the second ideology, along with fascism, that caused the greatest cataclysm in human history during World War II. You might have thought that we would have said, this is a singular occasion where we can thank God that we were born free and that we have the privilege of being able to help others be free because we defeated this great evil. And yet the opposite happened. There was no spirit of triumphalism. Rather, there was an immediate denial of what that meant. There was an immediate tendency to say, okay, now our job is done, and we're going to give responsibility for running things to people who reject the exceptionalism, not only of the United States of America, but of Western thought. We're going to hand responsibility for world leadership to the United Nations, a group that is comprised in the majority of nations that are ruled by dictators. So on a very basic level, by not embracing ourselves as the Western powers did at the end of World War II, but rather rejecting ourselves at our moment of greatest triumph, we set the stage for what came later, for what we today experience. Israel is an interesting example, and in fact, the precursor of what happens to the West. Because if Islam has bloody borders, and it is culturally expansionist, and it is, then Israel, the sole Western outpost in the Arab Islamic Middle East, is the front line of that civilizational struggle between Islam and its rejection of the basic foundations of Western civilization and the West. And indeed we see that trends that unfold in the West unfold a decade before in Israel. The same denial, the same rejection of exceptionalism, the same rejection of a right to discern and judge that we experience in the West today, we've experienced since the early 1990s in Israel. Now, I'll just give you a small example. One could say that the 2005 international riots that we experienced as a consequence of a very small Danish newspaper's decision to publish cartoons of Muhammad was a turning point. We could say that the idea that it was an act of bravery for a newspaper in the West to publish something, anything, that is a brave act, is a turning point. We never thought before the cartoon riots that it took bravery to do something like that. We took it for granted. You put up photographs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art of Jesus urinating, and that's okay. It may disgust people, it may offend people, but nobody questioned the fact that the artist had a right to draw whatever he wished, and that the museum, if they felt that this was aesthetically pleasing, could put up anything that they wish. So too of Muhammad. But no, it worked out that dozens of people were murdered because a publisher in Copenhagen decided that they were worthy of publication in his Jyllands-Posten newspaper. So one might say that the Danish government's decision to back the newspaper's right to publish those cartoons of Muhammad was an act of defiance and a defining moment in Danish history. And perhaps it was an example of Europe standing up for the basic rights that people enjoy as a matter of principle in the Western world. We could say that if we didn't then look and see what happened everywhere else. We didn't notice the fact that not one British paper agreed to publish those cartoons. We don't notice the fact that after the riots occurred, the European Union decided that freedom of speech had to be constrained by the newspapers of Europe in order not to offend Islam. We have to notice that, except for the Weekly Standard and perhaps the odd newspaper here and there in the United States, no U.S. publication published those cartoons. We have to ignore the fact that the brave publisher of the cartoons in Norway, who had a fundamentalist Christian newspaper with a circulation of about 7, had his life and the lives of his children threatened by the head of Norway's Muslim community, and was humiliated in public in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at the order of the Norwegian government, where he had to prostrate himself in front of the Muslim community of Norway and beg its forgiveness, and then was granted the protection of the Muslim leadership. The protection of the Muslim leadership, not of his government, of the people who had just threatened to kill his children. We have to forget that writers in France are in hiding and have been for 3 and 4 and 5 years for publishing articles attacking jihad in newspapers like Le Figaro. We have to ignore the death of intellectual debate in Europe because of fear by authors and writers that we'll be killed. So we can look at the Muhammad cartoon incident as a singular turning point, not of Western defiance and willingness to judge and be judged and to defend, but rather as a defining moment in which the West decided it didn't want to fight. It wanted to submit. In Israel, a similar occurrence happened 10 years earlier, or 8 years earlier, in 1997. In 1997, a young woman, not particularly talented, but who cares, named Tatiana Suskin, was living in Hebron. And in the aftermath of Arab riots against the Jewish community in Hebron, at the beginning of 1997, she drew a cartoon depicting Muhammad as a pig, and she pasted it up outside the door of a store in Hebron. She was sentenced to 2 years in prison for her act by an Israeli court, fearing that anything less was going to inspire widespread rioting among Palestinian and Arab Israelis who Israel was in the middle of giving land to. In fact, the same period where she put up a picture of Muhammad as a pig, then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was transferring security control over most of the city to the PLO. Why should they be angry? Why should they castigate the entire Jewish state because of the actions of one cartoonist? Why did she have to be sent to prison? If we feared them so much, why were we giving them land? And the answer is, because just as we see in the Western world since the end of the Cold War, a rejection of the foundations of Western civilization that enabled the victory of the West against the East in the Cold War. So too in Israel we see a fatigue with ideology, we see a fatigue with the notion of Jewish rights and the rightness of Zionism at the time that we were supposed to be most triumphant. After the Gulf War, we saw the demise of the PLO, which had sided with Saddam Hussein. We saw the rise of an American superpower, the one superpower as the sole global superpower. The United States was our ally. Our economy was booming. We were absorbing over 1 million Russian immigrants from the former Soviet Union. It was a wild time for Israel. It was the end of the Palestinian uprising that began at the end of 1987. We could have, at that moment, said, this is wonderful. We are strong. Our enemies are weak. Now, all we have to do is sit down and wait for them to accept us. But instead, in the moment of our greatest triumph, we said, we're responsible for their rejection of us. It's our fault that they don't like us. Let's make ourselves weak and strengthen them so that they may accept us. And we also said that the basis of peaceful coexistence with the Muslims was our rejection of our own exceptionalism. When I was in the peace talks, my general and Rabin of blessed memory and Shimon Peres and all the national leaders told us that the reason that the Palestinian Arabs and the rest of the Arab world rejected Israel was because we were too strong. We were humiliating them. We had to stop humiliating them. Palestinians had the highest education level, the highest level of political participation, the highest rate of freedom for Palestinian women. But we were humiliating them. So how did we decide not to humiliate them anymore? Well, we instituted a tyranny led by a terrorist organization and took away our support for Palestinian people and gave it all to a man named Yasser Arafat. That was our way of ending the humiliation so-called of Palestinian people, was to empower a mass murderer to tyrannize and terrorize the Palestinian Arabs. And guess what? It didn't work. It didn't work. By empowering your enemy, you make your enemy more powerful. You don't make him your friend. By saying we're sorry that you hate us, we're saying that you're right to hate us. We're not saying that you're wrong to hate us. By saying, I'm going to empower you, and I accept you as the sole legitimate leader of Palestinian Arabs, what you're saying is that Palestinian Arabs don't have a choice. You've instituted a tyranny, and you have told them that they have no choice other than to accept a dictator and his jackboot. What's peaceful about that? What's good-hearted about that? And yet, as part of this whole gestalt of multiculturalism and a Western rejection of the value of Western civilization, most Israelis didn't see it that way. Most Israelis refuse to acknowledge the fact that you cannot expect somebody to respect you when you are saying that you're not worthy of regard. If it's all your fault, then you're guilty. And you should be punished as guilty people should be punished for whatever crime it is that you committed. And the people who you wish to assuage your guilt by empowering them will not do that, since it's the very rejection on your part of your own exceptionalism that has empowered them. Then clearly, if they're logical, they'll say, well, then we want you to feel even guiltier. And indeed, nothing that you can do can exculpate that imaginary guilt that you embraced. Because it's imaginary to begin with. And so instead of appeasing your enemies, you're telling them that they're right to feel contempt for you, not only hatred. And lo and behold, we have a situation today where the Palestinians decided that there was no reason, given the state of Israel, to accept the wishy-washy leadership of the PLO that both killed Jews and talked to Jews if they could have the real deal with Hamas. They said, if the Jews are wrong, then they're completely wrong. There is no half-right and half-wrong, just as there's no half-pregnant and half-not-pregnant. If you're at fault, you're at fault. And if we're winning because you accept your own guilt, then we're going to crush you. But Israel, as the the leader of the Western world, as a country that's on the front lines of a global struggle that we refuse to acknowledge because we don't want to, because acknowledging it means that we're going to be required to make a decision whether we embrace who we are or succumb to powers that reject everything that we stand for. Israelis are placed in a situation where we have empowered the worst of our enemies. And now today, I would say that the change agenda that the United States has just embraced is not, in fact, an agenda of change. It's an agenda of return, of a return to a notion that we don't have to judge. What was, in fact, the most revolutionary change that Americans underwent after 9/11? It was a decision that we were going to judge. Right? But the change that Americans just embraced on Tuesday was a decision no longer to judge. And that's fine. Everybody can decide what they want to do. But you cannot decide, as Winston Churchill saw in the case of Germany, for others. And when you see from Iran to Gaza to Lebanon to Iraq, to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, to Morocco, to Algeria, to Tunisia, to the suburbs of Paris, to Northern Virginia, people calling for jihad and Islamic global domination. When you see these people developing weapons of mass destruction, whose only aim is genocide, when you see people openly stating in their newspapers, on their pulpits, in their universities, in their bookstores, that Jews are subhuman, that Americans and Europeans are infidels that need to be dominated, you have to ask yourself, what can we do in this environment if we have just determined that the change that we want is the right not to judge? And the answer is precious little. Now, I'm going to end with just one thought. I have a very close friend who just finished a 15-month stint in Iraq. He was a battalion commander first during the surge in Baghdad and then later in Diyala province. And he's back now. He left 2 weeks ago. And we were discussing the war in Iraq. And more I've begun to question the value of that war and whether really, the project of democratization of an Arab country is something that the Americans should have taken on themselves, given what happened inside of the American body politic as a result of the difficulty of undertaking such a project. And he said to me, "You know, Carolyn, you have to understand. Iraqis have changed." And I said, "What do you mean Iraqis have changed? How have they changed? They keep, you know, blowing up, they keep this, they keep that, they're squabbling, they're Shiites against Sunnis. Where do you see the change?" And he said, "The Iraqis have changed. We've changed them. Simply by being there and taking over that country, bringing down a tyrannical regime and empowering them, we've changed them. They no longer think that life is worthless. They have hope for the first time in their lives because of what we've done there. And if you think for a moment that that hope is going to recede after it's been given for the first time in centuries, you're wrong. I have police chiefs," he said, "in Diyala who are Shiites, who because of me and the relationships with the U.S. military have agreed and understand the necessity of arresting other Shiites. I have Sunnis who are willing to go after Sunnis and work with Shiites against Sunnis. This is something that never happened before, ever. And that basic idea of human hope, of a belief in a better future that I can make as an individual is something that was never seen before. And why is it important to finish on this point? Because when we look, and if we agree, as I do, that it was Samuel Huntington and not Francis Fukuyama who was correct in the 1990s in saying that there was a clash of civilizations and that its focal point was the bloody borders of Islam. And opposing those bloody borders was a Western world. Then we see that the clash is inevitable. Either they win or we do. There is no peaceful coexistence between two basic civilizational models, one that says that life is sacred and the other that says death is sacred. There can be no middle ground. And when we look at what's happening in Iraq today as a result of the extraordinary efforts, extraordinarily heroic efforts of the U.S. military, and yes, I'll say the stick-to-itiveness of President Bush, who didn't leave in the middle of a fight when it got difficult, then we see that change is possible. And we see also that victory comes in very strange ways. But when it comes because we are willing not to deny our own exceptionalism, but to embrace it, to act as a light to the nations because of who we are, because of how we live, because of how we treat women and children and men and boys, because of what we think the essence of humanity truly is. That's when we win. And we lose when, on the other hand, we say, we might be right, but why rock the boat? And then little by little, by little by little, we see our ways of life changing, and not for the better. When cartoonists in Denmark are in hiding now for 3 years, our lives are not changing for the better. When conservative speakers can't speak on U.S. campuses without 20 security guards, we're not changing for the better. But when a Shiite Arab in Diyala province can recognize the need to arrest Shiites who are terrorists, who are under the thumb of Iran, things are changing for the better. And that was a change that the United States made. And that was a change that the American people made. And it was for the better. My book, as a friend of mine said, came about because that friend of mine said to me, Carolyn, you and your columns, the chronicle of the global war that nobody wishes to acknowledge. And I thought to myself, yes, the war that we all deny. And I said, well then perhaps I should make them into a book. Perhaps I should take all of the columns and tell a story about that war that we don't want to look at and that we don't want to fight and that we refuse to win. Whose stakes are so high that we don't even like to contemplate them. Because maybe if I put them together in a book and I have a glossy cover on it, people might read it. And if they read it, maybe they'll recognize that the determination of whether we live in a peaceful age or a war or an age of war is not our decision to make alone. We can only do our best, raise children, live our lives in a way that promotes the values that engender peace. But we can't make people accept those values unless we're willing to fight for them. We can't make people accept our right to be who we are unless we're willing to say that who we are is worth defending. America made a decision last week. The jury's still out about what that's going to mean. But what's very clear is that if America decides that it wishes to turn its back on history, that always moves forward at an inexorable pace, regardless of whether we wish to participate or not, things will not be for the better. Not for Israel, not for the United States, and not for the notion of human freedom. So I thank you very much. I encourage all of you to buy my book and to buy books for all of your friends and relatives, not even acquaintances, people you just happen to pass on the street. And since I'm here, any books you buy, I'd be happy to sign. So I'd be happy to also take some questions right now. Thank you. Yeah, you do need a microphone. See, look at that, huh?
I'd like to ask you the following question. Since you are a right winger, and I'm probably one of the few in this audience that is also a right winger, who is going to win the election? We all hope it's Bibi, but who's going to win the election in Israel?
Well, since we all hope it's Bibi, then it'll be Bibi, right? Because if everybody believes that it's going to be Bibi and wants it to be Bibi, she's going to win the Assadian majority of 99.9%, you know, right? So, I think the polls are not clear right now what direction the Israeli electorate is going, except for one thing, which is that, you know, in Israel, it's all coalition politics. So really, since the 1970s or so, there hasn't been a party like Labor, for instance, Mapai, that has so many, thank you very much, JJ, that has so many votes that they can make a coalition almost on their own. So you need to have a bloc. And so in Israel, we have blocs of parties. We have left-wing blocs of parties, and we have right-wing blocs of parties, and we have parties that can't quite decide what they want to be when they grow up, and we have Arab parties. And right now, when we look at the sum total of the polls in Israel for blocs rather than for specific parties, Kadima versus Likud in this issue, we see that the right-wing bloc has a majority, you know, 120 seats in the Knesset. Right now, they're polling around between 67 and 73. So that's what it looks like. But, you know, I mean, look at the difference between the polls after the Republican convention and the results of the election. I mean, things can change on a dime. That's democracy for you. There's a line here. How are we doing this, just so I understand?
We're going to decide. We'll take one from this side, one question from that.
Okay, fine. So, to my left, yes.
This morning, New York Times, it was a full-day day, by 52 Muslim countries, saying how much they're begging for peace. Israel would only accept King of Saudi Arabia's proposal for peace. Like me,
I'll repeat the question. So, I didn't see the ad, but the gentleman says that there's a full-page ad in the New York Times of members, I guess, of the Arab League, saying that they want to have peace with Israel, and all Israel has to do is accept the Saudi initiative from March 2002, and then everything will be fine. But the small print in that statement is that what they want is peace after Israel is destroyed, because the Saudi plan of 2002 is predicated not only on an Israeli return to the 1949 armistice lines, including a repartition of Jerusalem, and withdrawal from the entire West Bank and from the Golan Heights, as well as Gaza, of course, which is now under Hamas control, but also an Israeli acceptance of unlimited immigration of some 4.5 million hostile Arabs whose grandparents may or may not have lived in the Palestine-mandated territories before they left in 1948. So it's an awfully nice plan on the face of it, but when you read the fine print, what they're saying is that we will accept Israel, and they don't actually even say in the Saudi initiative that they're going to have peaceful relations with Israel after we commit national suicide, but rather that they will have, what is the term, reasonable relations with Israel. Or what? Normal relations with Israel. Normal. So, you know, I'm waiting for a better offer.
Okay, we'll take a question. Yes.
I want to thank you so much for your very eloquent elucidation of the ideological steps that have led us to this present quandary that we find ourselves in here. And my question sort of comes from, in a sense, a liturgical, biblical perspective here. Every year when we come to the Parashat Balak and we read of the Moabite preacher Bilam, who set out to curse Israel and in the end was only able to praise Israel, I've felt for so long that what the world really needs, what Israel needs and the free world needs, are a number of Bilams from within the Arabic world to step out and try and change and modify Islam. Now, I know this has happened a little bit. There's a Canadian writer who has written a book on this very eloquently. But given the amount of Saudi influence, particularly Saudi influence of funding terrorism, terrorist acts, and also funding the Wahhabi schools throughout the entire world, How can this process be accelerated so that the change can come more from within the Arab world, and we're not facing armies of a billion Muslims who become terrorists through these indoctrination processes?
That's an excellent question. And, you know, I always say that my golden rule for politics, and I try to implement it in my personal life, but everybody falls from time to time, is that if you want to be successful, you have to do two things. You have to be good to your friends, and you have to be bad to your enemies. Because then people will want to be your friends, and they won't want to be your enemies. It's very simple. And yet, that basic logic that I probably learned from my kindergarten teacher is ignored because we like to be too clever by half and say, no, what we really have to do is be nasty to our friends, stick it to them, and kiss up to our enemies, because then our friends will what? And our enemies will have contempt for us. So that's a great strategy that has been adopted actually in full or in large part by most Western democracies. And it doesn't work. And when you look at people like Noni Darwish and Irshad Manji, who you're talking about, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Zuhdi Jasser, and countless others, actually not countless, a number of other extremely brave, courageous, and wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Muslims. My colleague at the Jerusalem Post, our Palestinian affairs correspondent, Khaled Abu Tuhameh, who I am extremely grateful to be able to consider to be one of my closest friends. When we look at these people who are willing to stand up to evil when it comes from their own house, just think about how hard that is. If you've had friends or family members who do bad things, and you have to actually stand up to them and say, you know, the person that you hurt was right in this situation and not you, even though you're my brother. Think about how hard that is, and think about how brave these people are. They have to be supported. We have to be embracing them. We have to be saying that we are in awe of you for what you do. What I do is easy. I'm Jewish. You know, if I love them or hate them, it doesn't really matter. But think about these extraordinary individuals in the Arab world who are standing up for freedom, who are standing up for women's rights, who are standing up for Jews. And yet, when we want to have an authentic Arab voice on the U.S. media or in our synagogues or whatever, when we want to have an intercultural or interreligious dialogue, we tend to invite representatives of the PLO, of the Committee on American-Islamic Relations, which is a Hamas, you know, front organization, the Islamic Circle of North America, so that they can all say that Israel is bad, that America is bad, that we got some splaining to do for our way of life, and that we're all Islamophobes. Because why? Because we have some sort of very strange objection to suicide bombers. The people who are on our side are there because they're good people. And we should be embracing them because they deserve to be supported. And I would really encourage everybody to find their people in your own community and help them do what they're doing. Yes?
Kevin. Just wanted to say personally, I think you're a gift from Hashem, and I pray for you every day.
You and my mom.
I'm going to depress everybody with this question, but the 30 years since I immigrated here from Iran, I concluded that, with all due respect, American Jews are very naive. This last 7, 8, 10 years, we've just been sitting here discussing policy, this, that, this, that. I think it's irrelevant. Now the question needs to be upfront, given the disaster that happened here last week. The question is, there should be a public debate that the Muslims need to clearly understand about what the repercussions will be if they use any type of mass weapon of destruction to attack Israel or America. I don't hear any of this discussion, and the Muslims need to clearly understand
what the repercussions are going to be.
Could we begin to have a public debate and explain it to the Muslims what the ramification would be if they use the weapon?
Well, you know, I really do appreciate you praying for me, but I think you're wrong about the need to have a debate about what's going to happen to people if they nuke Jews. I think that we've been doing far too much talking. I think that when we talk endlessly about what's going to happen if you do something has not brought anything, because we're not willing to stand behind our threats, and Israel and the United States have repeatedly turned their backs on their own ultimatums and threats, then you just become a laughingstock when you have these kinds of discussions. You become objects of contempt, because what you're showing is that what you really like to do is talk, but you're not going to walk the walk. I think that after the Holocaust, with all due respect, the Jewish community in the United States, and to a certain degree also in Israel, took the wrong lesson away. I believe that there's really only one lesson for Jews from the Holocaust, and that is that it can happen. It happens. Not never again, it shall never happen again, but that be careful, man. It can happen. We're talking about Germany, and we're talking about the nations of Western Europe, not Indian tribes, you know, who have no commonality culturally with the Western settlers in the United States of that time. We are talking about the most advanced civilizations, the most advanced countries in Western civilizations, embracing with such enthusiasm the murder of Jews. And you want to tell me that that's not going to happen again? Because what we have here is this embrace of the Holocaust is some sort of sui generis act that happened once in our history, as opposed to just the latest attempt to annihilate the Jews in our long history. And when we have these discussions about whether it can or cannot happen, what we're saying is that we deny that history. And what we're saying is that there's something okay about people like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the heads of Hamas and the heads of Hezbollah and the heads of Egypt saying that Jews have no right to exist. We're saying that this is a pro and con discussion, not up for discussion. And we have to stop that. We have to stop that. We have to stop saying it'll be a game changer if Iran gets nuclear weapons. What does that mean? We're not in a game. This is not a game. And when we talk, oh, we want more sanctions. Why? They're speeding along towards the entrance to the nuclear club, and they've made very clear they're not interested in mutual assured destruction, because all we're going to be doing is helping them out if we send them up to their 72 virgins. They've said it. Israel's only one country. But there are 50 Islamic countries, said the supposed moderate Iranian leader Rafsanjani in 1997. We don't care if they nuke us back. So where's the deterrence in that? We have a shot at survival. It involves destroying Iran's nuclear installations. We want to talk about it. We are enabling our destruction. Time to talk is over.
When are they going to do it?
Many people have wanted to ask questions. I'm going to take one more from this side in the back there, because this gentleman's hand has been up from way from the beginning. And we'll take one more from that side, and then really we have to allow Ms. Flick to go and sign the books, and perhaps you can chat with her then.
We have to let Ms. Flick sign the books that you're all going to buy.
Thank you.
quote from Abraham Lincoln, but he made it very clear already in the 1850s that the only force that could bring down the United States was the United States. He made clear, he understood already then what the actual threat was to the notion of union here in the United States. And he said, it isn't going to be Britain, which was, you know, waiting in the wings to see the United States destroy itself so that they could take over the South again. It wasn't France. The United States. We forget, by the way, that until the late 19th century, the United States was not a powerful country. And it was under threat of invasion and destruction, not only from within, but also from Britain. If you look at the history of the United States around the time of Andrew Jackson, for instance, you'll see a very weak democracy that stood for something, and therefore was a focus of a lot of hatred and aggression around the world. When we look at the issue of standing up, of how we can survive, we have to recognize that we are our own worst enemies. And that was really the theme that I was trying to bring out in my talk, because the notion of multiculturalism, of everybody getting together and singing Kumbaya around a fire and saying we're all wonderful and we are all the world, is beautiful. But before you can get to that bonfire and hold hands, there have to be a couple of things that are agreed upon. Most importantly, the sanctity of human life, whoever it belongs to. When we reject that, when we say, no, 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 it's not us who can decide, or as the education minister of Israel, Yuli Tamir, did in 1996, said, you can't, for instance, attack female genital mutilation because doing so will cause us to feel triumphant as a society and therefore feel that our values and virtues are better than the people who mutilate girls, we won't be able to appease them. We have to be able to take our public debate out of the realm of dementia, where it is now located, and bring it to focus on the world as it is. How do we do that? One voice at a time. You know, you were talking about the question of law and the question of how are we able to have a war when we're a war of ideas, when we're allowing our enemies to set the terms of debate in such a way that we'll always lose it. Well, here you have a neighbor with JJ who told me beforehand when we were sitting together that he has been putting together an international law forum here in San Diego at the JCC to try to have people understand better what international law is, what international humanitarian law is, and what is the double standard with Israel, but also what the actual law says and why it is that international law does not actually see, I turned that off, does not actually see Israel as the occupier. But we don't have that discussion. You have people here at home who you can work with. And so the question is, why don't we have more people like me? Well, we do. We have lots and lots of people like me. But we have to know how to work together and to help one another. And again, we have to be good to our friends and bad to our enemies, because then everybody will want to be our friends. Nobody will want to be our enemies, okay?
I just want to thank you for your articles over the years and tell you how courageous you are, because as you're describing our Western civilization, your views are not popular, and I'm very happy to hear somebody with your views, and, you know, I hope we'll be successful in maybe presenting to the, you know, to our own people a view of the world that's a little more sanguine. And as a last question, I just wondered, if you understood, because you mentioned in your talk that the Holocaust has not been so far back, and how is it that, that the Israelis, if they're going to stay in Israel and not run to the States or elsewhere, are trying so hard to avoid reality?
Reality is crushing sometimes. It's just hard. And people will go to any lengths not to have to contend with it oftentimes. I mean, just think about Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That the first thing that you have to do if you want to be cured of your alcohol addiction and move on with your life is you have to do what? You have to acknowledge that you're an alcoholic. And everybody always says, and I had a good friend who unfortunately became an alcoholic, and I saw how difficult it was for him to recognize that he was an alcoholic. And how many times did I have to sit down and say to him, that's horrible. You're sick. You need help. And he denied it when I said it and when his other friends said it and when his family said it and his wife said it because he didn't want to believe. And we know how difficult it is. You know, everybody always says that Thomas Jefferson was a radical because he said that a little revolution now and again is a good thing. And that he foresaw a continuous revolution. But let me tell you something about that statement from the way I see it. Thomas Jefferson recognized a very basic truth, which is that you don't have change, real change, revolutionary change, very often, because people are willing to put up with just about everything before they're going to stand up and face the facts. I got to go into rehab. I got to go to war. Whatever it happens to be. And so it really wasn't a radical statement. Perhaps it was more of a wish to say, let it be easier for us to recognize when we have to change. Let it be something that doesn't take the almost insurmountable courage or immeasurable courage that it took for the founding fathers of the United States and for the early Zionists to recognize that something had to give in a very fundamental and foundational way about the nature of life, whether it was here or in Jewish shtetls in Eastern and Central Europe, that something had to give. And perhaps what Jefferson was really saying, let that be easier to occur. Let that take less courage. Let that take less exceptionalism. And what we find, of course, is that, no, in fact, the reason why these people are so remembered, and every 5 minutes there's another biography of these great men and women, is because what they did was so extraordinary. And so when we look at Israel and the challenges facing Israel today, I would say that Israelis are awake, but the temptation to go back to sleep is very, very strong. And the ability of leaders to strengthen the courage of Israelis is diminished as a result of both the inherent tendency of man to ignore reality and also of all of the voices coming from outside, both within Israel and then throughout the Western world, that tells us to sleep and to sleep and to sleep. And so I think that we have seen a fundamental shift in Israeli society since 2000. I think that there's an overwhelming acknowledgement of the fact that the peace process with the Palestinians was a fraudulent peace process. But on the other hand, we still haven't changed the discourse in such a way that really engenders a discussion that is more relevant to the challenges we face. But I think that it's moving in that direction. Sometimes it's incremental. And what we're seeing in Israel is an incremental shift. So those are my thoughts. And I do want to end with one thing, though, because I don't want everybody to go off and slit their wrists and say the end of the world is nigh. I think that I wouldn't be doing what I do, and my colleagues who are doing the same thing in a million different ways, and the people that I meet in Israel and the United States, and even in Europe, although I don't go there very often, it is a testament to the vitality of the nature of who we are. And I think that people are a lot more courageous than we give ourselves credit for. I certainly don't feel alone, ever. I don't feel isolated, ever. And I don't think any of my colleagues do either. And I have enormous faith in our ability to prevail and to wake up in time and to mount the challenges that we face, confront them, and emerge victorious. I don't see that receding. I think that the temptation exists not to, but I still believe very, very strongly that not only is it not over till the fat lady sings, but it's not over till we win. And I think we will win, and I think that we are going to, we are moving in the right direction. So we don't have to be depressed and despair. We just have to recognize that there's a great amount of work before us and take it on as a privilege to fight for who we are. Thank you
so much for that.